Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro. Show, they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
G
G-Wagon, all different days. The gallon, ride the wind. I know you, die or nothing. Make you no say anything when you do, them must commend it.
I can't come and keep myself.
So anything when they do, I they try to they do on my way.
I can't come and keep myself.
Plenty, 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 so far we face. Just to make some money, day. But my people can go say, I know one buy, I know one die, I know one spend me. I want enjoy, I want chop life, I want buy motor, I want build house, I still want to know. Tell me, my nigga, what you come? G-Wagon, all the Bentley, take your step, ride the whip, I know fee, die for nothing. My nigga, what's it gonna be? G-Wagon, all the Bentley, take your step, ride the whip, I know fee. Different things them happening, schemes and packaging. In a one night for shows I'm juggling. Flow like the ocean, my boat I'm paddling. Shout out Shina fella, that's my bro, my family. Rose in jail. When it comes to money I they concentrate. Make I tell you straight, you are not my mate. If you become a shall I be head of state. But my people then go say I know one buy, I know one die, I know one family. I want enjoy, I want chop life, I want buy motor, I want build house, I still want to know. Money what's it gonna be? G-Wagon, all the Bentley, stick your step, ride the whip, I know V, die for nothing. My nigga, what's it gonna be? G-Wagon, all the Bentley, stick your step, ride the whip, I know V, die for nothing.
Black power, black power, black power, brothers and sisters. You are listening to the new Black Panther Party for Self-Defense nightly broadcast coming to you live here in the belly of America, KKK, broadcasting all over God's green, beautiful, blue, and green, and vibrant planet Earth. To the melanated people all over the planet, we're sending you much love. To our brothers and sisters that are listening on the continent of Africa, Israelite, Africa. We thank you very much for listening in the many countries that are listening in the mother continent of Africa, as we do know it is very late night. And as far as all of our people that are listening all over the planet, in UK and Canada and Australia and China and South America, Central America, in the Caribbean Islands, in the West Indies, in the Pacific Isles, all over the planet, wherever you may be listening, we give you a Black Power salute. We thank you for your continued support of the new Black Panther Party for Self-Defense nightly broadcast. Coming to you live here in America, KKK, we send a shout out to all of our brothers and sisters who are here in this Belly of the Beast with us, battling out with the beast. As you know, on Tuesday and Thursday night is our Pan-African broadcast, where we give you updates on what's going on in the continent of Africa and throughout the diaspora, wherever our people are. And on Tuesday nights, we play our best source that we've had so far, and we are constantly looking for other sources of outlets of information to keep us plugged into what's going on the motherland. So we found this powerful channel called Pan-African TV. So today we are going to hear the current events from a program, two programs, one entitled Good Morning Africa, and the other program is entitled Hot News. So without further ado, let's get the update on what's going on the continent as we play this first clip from today's episode of Good Morning Africa, which will be followed up by the Hot News, Black Power.
Contributions on our WhatsApp, your text line, make a time and read those examples. Those of you watching us on Facebook can share the Facebook live for other people to also watch tonight's edition of the program. My name is Justice Opiani. Tonight on Hot News, we are unpacking the Supreme Court ruling on the rights of deputy speakers, to vote. No article in the Constitution that bars the deputy speakers from voting in Parliament. This has generated a lot of issues with the minority having, their view on the matter. The minority in Parliament described the ruling as a travesty of parliamentary justice. But the majority in Parliament has also welcomed, the ruling from the Supreme Court. The former President John Dramani Mahama has also described the ruling or the judgment as regrettable and has advised the applicant to go for a review. President Akufo-Addo has also been of which the Speaker of Parliament has responded to him. The Speaker of on the ruling, and it's certainly what we are discussing on joined in the studio by the Member of Parliament for Tamale North constituency, Honourable Al-Hassan Soyine. Honourable, good evening. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good evening, Justice. Thank you very much for having me.
Very well. Finally, you are here.
Right.
Right. Also in the studio is a private legal practitioner, lawyer Abdul Fattah Al-Hassan, popularly known as Jofa. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and good evening to your cherished viewers.
Right, right. I'll start with you, Honourable Soyine, on why you have described the judgment by the Supreme Court as a travesty of parliamentary justice. The Supreme Court has been very clear on the matter. They are saying that, yes, Article 102 of the 1992 Constitution is clear on forming a quorum. 104, of course, is also clear, members of parliament voting and all of that, and that the Constitution under 104 has not barred any, Speaker of Parliament, Deputy Speaker of Parliament from voting on the floor of Parliament. Considering the fact that they are members of Parliament who have been voted for, they've been elected to represent
a constituency or constituencies, and by so doing,
you are disenfranchising their constituents.
I mean, what's your view on this, and why have you described the said judgment as a travesty of justice?
Well, first of all, I think that we need to put a few things into perspective as far as the analysis of this judgment is concerned. One, we on the minority side have never argued that a deputy speaker cannot vote or is not entitled to vote. Because even on the day that the minority prevented the first deputy speaker from voting because he was presiding, there was another deputy speaker representing the people of Fomina who was not prevented from voting. At every point in time, deputy speakers, when they are not presiding, have never been prevented from voting, not in this 8th Parliament, and I don't know of previous parliaments, but in the 7th Parliament, deputy speakers used to vote. So no one has ever been in doubt about the need of a deputy speaker to represent his constituents. So you hear the analysis as if to say that we in the minority are saying that once you assume the title or the position deputy speaker, we are arguing that it denies you the opportunity to represent your constituents. That has never been our argument. Our argument has been that when you are presiding, then you are expected to be impartial and you are expected to be a fair umpire. And so you are not to exercise your vote when you are presiding. And I'll, you know, explain that further. The second issue that we need to also put into perspective is the fact that even as the ruling of the Supreme Court stands, even as we disagree with that ruling and hope that a review will set it aside,
right,
in my view, it is still a vindication of what the minority in Parliament did in preventing the Deputy Speaker of Parliament from voting on the day that he attempted to vote. Why? If you look at Article 110 of our Constitution, it states clearly that Parliament will be guided, will have the opportunity to set up its own procedures. So maybe for the benefit of doubt, let me just
That's actually what it
is. I was paraphrasing, but let me just quote what it says.
Right.
Yes. So it says 1101. Subject to the provisions of this Constitution, Parliament may, by standing orders, regulate its own procedure. Now, going by this, until this ruling, the standing orders of Parliament had in it, under 109, that a deputy speaker will not have the right to vote.
But is that what the Constitution says?
Wait a minute. There is something they say about law not having retrospective effect.
Okay.
They are the lawyers.
Right.
Law does not have retrospective effect. So until the Supreme Court ruling, and I'm saying as it stands now, until it is set aside, I consider their ruling a vindication of what the minority did on the day we prevented the Deputy Speaker from voting. Why? Because until the ruling that just came, the standing orders was in line with 110. Of our 1992 Constitution. It is now that the Supreme Court is setting aside that provision in our standing orders. Until they set it aside, it was part of the standing orders of Parliament.
Okay.
And so, if you look at 109 of our standing orders, it is clear that we did... No, it's not 109. 190, is that it? 1093, thank you. So 1093 of the standing or a deputy speaker or a
other people to also watch tonight's edition of the program. My name is Justice Opiah, and tonight on Hot News, we are unpacking the Supreme Court
from the top.
We'll make a time and read out those samples. Those of you watching us on Facebook can share the Facebook Live for other people to also watch tonight's edition of the program. My name is Justice Opiah, and tonight on Hot News, we are unpacking the Supreme Court ruling on the rights of deputy speakers, to vote. No article in the Constitution that bars the deputy speakers from voting in Parliament. This has generated a lot of issues with the minority having, their view on the matter. The minority in Parliament described the ruling as a travesty of parliamentary justice. But the majority in Parliament has also welcomed, the ruling from the Supreme Court.
The former president, John Dramani Mahama, has also described the ruling or the judgment as regrettable and has advised the applicant to go for a review. President Akufo-Addo has also been of which the Speaker of Parliament has responded to him. The Speaker of on the ruling, and exactly what we are discussing on joined in the studio by the Member of Parliament for Tamale North constituency, Honorable Al-Hassan Soyine. Honorable, good evening. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good evening, Justice. Thank you very much for having me.
Very well. Finally, you are here.
Right.
Right. Also in the studio is a private legal practitioner, lawyer Abdul Fattah Al-Hassan, popularly known as Jofa. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and good evening to your cherished viewers.
Right, right. I'll start with you, Honorable Soyine, on why you have described the judgment by the Supreme Court as a travesty of parliamentary justice. The Supreme Court has been very clear on the matter. They are saying that, yes, Article 102 of the 1992 Constitution
is clear on forming a quorum. 104, of course, is also clear, on members of parliament voting and all of that, and that the Constitution under 104 has not barred any, Speaker of Parliament, Deputy Speaker of Parliament from voting on the floor of parliament. Considering the fact that they are members of parliament who have been voted for, they've been elected to represent
a constituency or constituencies, and by so doing,
you are disenfranchising their constituents.
I mean, what's your view on this, and why have you described the said judgment as a travesty of justice?
Well, first of all, I think that we need to put a few things into perspective as far as the analysis of this judgment is concerned. One, we on the minority side have never argued that a deputy speaker cannot vote or is not entitled to vote, because even on the day that the minority prevented the first deputy speaker from voting because he was presiding, there was another deputy speaker representing the people of Fomina who was not prevented from voting. At every point in time, deputy speakers, when they are not presiding, have never been prevented from voting, not in this 8th parliament, and I don't know of previous parliaments, but in the 7th parliament, deputy speakers used to vote. So no one has ever been in doubt about the need of a deputy speaker to represent his constituents. So you hear the analysis as if to say that we in the minority are saying that once you assume the title or the position deputy speaker, we are arguing that it denies you the opportunity to represent your constituents. That has never been our argument. Our argument has been that when you are presiding, then you are expected to be impartial and you are expected to be a fair umpire. And so you are not to exercise your vote when you are presiding. And I'll, explain that further. The second issue that we need to also put into perspective is the fact that even as the ruling of the Supreme Court stands, even as we disagree with that ruling and hope that a review will set it aside.
Right.
In my view, it is still a vindication of what the minority in Parliament did in preventing the Deputy Speaker of Parliament from voting on the day that he attempted to vote. Why? If you look at Article 110 of our Constitution, it states clearly that Parliament will be guided, will have the opportunity to set up its own procedures. So maybe for the benefit of doubt, let me just...
That's actually what it is.
Yeah, I was paraphrasing, but let me just quote what it says.
Right.
Yes. So it says 1101, subject to the provisions of this Constitution, Parliament may by standing orders regulate its own procedure. Now, going by this, until this ruling, the standing orders of Parliament had in it, under 109, that a deputy speaker will not have the right to vote.
But is that what the Constitution says?
Wait a minute. There is something they say about law not having retrospective effect.
Okay.
They are the lawyers.
Right.
Law does not have retrospective effect.
Hmm.
So until the Supreme Court ruling, and I'm saying as it stands now, until it is set aside, I consider their ruling a vindication of what the minority did on the day we prevented the Deputy Speaker from voting. Why? Because until the ruling that just came, the standing orders was in line with 110 of our 1992 Constitution. It is now that the Supreme Court is setting aside that provision in our standing orders. Until they set it aside, it was part of the standing orders of Parliament.
Okay.
And so, if you look at 109 of our standing orders, it is clear that we did... No, it's not 109. 190, is that it? 1093, thank you. So 1093 of the standing order. A deputy speaker or any other member presiding shall not retain his original vote while presiding. That's 1093.
This derives its validity from the Constitution under Article 104, isn't it?
I'll get there.
104 didn't say that a deputy speaker, is that a speaker?
I'll get there. I'm just telling you the two things that we have to put into perspective.
Okay.
The first one being that, as a minority, our argument has never been that a deputy speaker can't vote. Our argument has only been that when he is presiding, he can't vote. And that is clearly captured under 1093 of the standing orders, which until the Supreme Court ruling was in line with 110, where we were told under 110 that Parliament may, by standing orders, regulate its own procedure.
Okay.
So, until the ruling came, the whole of this standing orders was used to regulate our procedure in Parliament.
Mm.
So, if this ruling says, if this current ruling says that they are expunging 1093, I am saying, and I'm submitting, like the lawyers will say, that what we did, at the time we did it, was lawful. Preventing the deputy speaker from voting was lawful because at the time 1093 was part of our standing orders and it was lawful.
Right.
And it needed to be respected. Are you getting the point I'm making?
There you go.
So I'm saying until the Supreme Court ruling is set aside, which we believe will be set aside if, you know, the review process is given a fair hearing, even as it stands now, that ruling vindicates the minority's decision to disallow the deputy speaker from voting on the day that he tried to vote.
Okay.
Now let's look at why we strongly believe that this judgment is flawed.
Okay.
If you look at Article 295 of our Constitution, 295, it's what do they say? It defines some of the terms and interpretation sections of the Constitution. So it interprets the Constitution for you.
Okay.
So under 295, you have 2951 in this constitution, unless the context otherwise requires, Act of Parliament, then all of that, you know, they speak of all the things that you need to take into consideration when you are reading the constitution. But then it also says something quite interesting. Just permit me to get to that portion.
Right.
And I should have marked it on my way here. In fact, it's actually 2952. In this constitution and in any other law, a reference to the holder of an office by the term designating his office shall, unless the context otherwise requires, be construed as including a reference to a person for the time being lawfully acting in or performing the functions of that office. Mm. So the office of speaker is there. The speaker is there. But this provision says that unless the context otherwise requires, it will be construed as including a reference to a person for the time being lawfully acting in or performing the functions of that office. So anytime you have somebody lawfully acting as speaker and performing the functions of the office of speaker, the same responsibility that you place on the speaker is placed on that person. The same responsibility you place on the speaker is placed on that person.
Okay.
And you see, it's not for nothing that even in our constitution, it is required of a speaker to resign even when he is an MP and he's elected speaker. It is to suggest the need for the person presiding to be impartial at the time that he or she is presiding. Otherwise, why will we require a speaker to resign when he is elected as a speaker, to resign as a member of parliament when he is elected as a speaker? We require that because it is expected that the person occupying that position should be impartial, should not take part or should not have sides when there is a debate on the floor, because parliament is a house of debate. So when you have someone acting in his position, the same responsibility is expected of that person. And see, the ruling is quite interesting. The ruling actually confers all the rights and responsibilities of the speaker on the deputy speaker. They don't question the fact that the deputy speaker, you know, is to play all the roles of the speaker. But then when it comes to the issue of voting, at the time that he is presiding, they want, or the issue of taking side, let me not just say voting, the issue of taking side, then they say he can take sides. Apart from all the responsibilities and rights of a speaker accruing to the person, they do not expect the person to carry the liabilities. It doesn't happen anywhere. Where?
Are you not looking at the issue from just one side? Because the Supreme Court in its reasoning has also indicated that the deputy speaker or the deputy speakers are members of parliament. They have been elected by their constituents. They are representing those constituents in parliament. If you deny any of them their vote at the time they are presiding in parliament, are you not disenfranchising their constituents and all of that, of the third vote in parliament?
That is why I started by saying there was a need to put it, to put one thing in perspective, that the Speaker of Parliament, I mean the Deputy Speaker of Parliament, is never denied his right to vote at all times, unless when he's presiding. You cannot expect all the rights to accrue to you when you are presiding and shy away from the responsibilities. So when you are not presiding, you still occupy the position as Deputy Speaker. That is why their sitting is different from all other members of parliament. They sit in front of the speaker. The two deputy speakers sit right in front of the speaker. Their offices are different. Their staff is different. So
when you are not presiding, you still occupy the position as deputy speaker. But when a vote is called on a matter in the house, you vote. When you are not presiding, you vote. They vote all the time. But we are saying that when you look at all our laws, there's a reason why when you are presiding, you are excluded from voting. Look at Article 102 of the Constitution.
Okay.
Where even the footnote in the Constitution says quorum in Parliament.
Mm.
Quorum. Determining quorum in Parliament. And you see, I've done a simple definition. Sorry, the marginal note. Thank you, the marginal note. I have done a simple interpretation or definition of quorum. And there is no definition I have seen in my search of quorum that does not include voting. We vote to form a quorum or counting. So quorum in itself is a vote. You vote to determine whether there is a quorum. You count yourselves to determine whether there is a quorum. Mm. The process of determining a quorum involves voting. I don't know if you are getting the point I'm making.
I get it. Yeah.
So 102 says, a quorum of parliament, apart from the person presiding, shall be one-third of the members of parliament. And they say the constitution is a living organism with different organs. So you have to look at it in a whole. So before you even understand 102 well, look at 101. It says, the speaker shall preside in parliament at all sittings, and in his absence, a deputy speaker shall preside. Mm. Three things to look out for. The speaker, preside, deputy speaker. Three things. The speaker, the deputy speaker, preside. Those are the three words you should take into consideration. Then when you come to 102, it drops the speaker. It drops the deputy speaker. Mm. But it says, a quorum of parliament, apart from the person presiding, shall be one-third of all members of parliament.
Right.
So, in this case, it is telling you that the three can be used interchangeably. The speaker, the deputy speaker, the presiding person. That's what it is telling you, that it can be used interchangeably.
Isn't it the case that it is also differentiating the deputy speaker from the speaker?
Listen to the 101. Mm. The speaker shall preside in parliament at all sittings, and in his absence, a deputy speaker shall preside.
So the deputy speaker is not the speaker.
But he will preside. But he will preside.
Mm.
You understand? He will preside.
Right.
Then when it comes to 102, it says a quorum of parliament apart from the person presiding. So in that case, it is telling you that it doesn't matter whether it's a speaker or it's a deputy speaker.
Right.
The person presiding will not be included in a quorum. And remember, I told you,
it may not be the speaker himself.
It may or
be. It could be a deputy speaker.
It could be a deputy speaker. That's what I'm saying, that it can be used interchangeably.
Right.
So it's telling you here that either the speaker or the deputy speaker, whoever is presiding, shall not be counted when you are determining quorum.
Mm.
And I'm saying that quorum itself, the process of determining quorum itself, involves voting. It involves counting.
Mm.
So clearly, I fail to understand how the framers of the Constitution will exclude the person presiding from forming a quorum. But when it comes to making a decision, you think the person presiding can take part in making a decision. And that's under 1041. It says, except as otherwise provided in this Constitution, matters in Parliament shall be determined by the votes of the majority of members present and voting, with at least half of the members of Parliament present.
Right.
The Speaker shall have neither an original nor casting vote. Where the votes on any motion are equal, it shall be considered Lord. Where Parliament is considered a bill, and blah, blah. Now, here, we are told that the Deputy Speaker is not mentioned.
Yes.
And because the Deputy Speaker is not mentioned, he can take part
in the voting process.
Mm. But you see, if the Constitution was going to list everything that it expects us to do, I think that it would have been more voluminous than this. It has already provided for you that to even determine if you can sit to do business, the person presiding is not part. I mean, that's the basic principle. That to even determine to do, like to decide whether you can do business, don't count the person presiding. How then do you think that the framers of the Constitution had in mind that when it comes to taking important decisions, the person presiding should now be part? Because you see,
the Constitution mentioned the speaker.
What I'm saying is that, no, I'm talking about that.
The speaker shall not have neither, you know, casting votes or whatever. I think under Article 1042,
yes,
it says the speaker shall have neither an original nor casting vote.
But you see,
here, it, don't you think that...
Follow the trend, Justice. Follow the trend. Follow the trend. Yes, follow the trend of the argument.
I get your argument.
Now, I told you in 101...
Mm.
The three, they have been given a certain responsibility and a certain role in 101. The presiding person, the speaker, and the deputy speaker.
Yes.
In 102, they are given a certain exemption again. And I'm saying that in 102, the exemption is even when you are doing the basic, determining whether you can have a meeting. They are exempted from being counted. Then 104 is when you are taking decisions. And when they list the speaker, I'm saying they don't have to repeat again the presiding person and the speaker and the deputy speaker. They have already done that in 101 and 102. They have already done that in 101 and 102. And again, Justice, in 295, they have also told you that anybody who assumes that position, whether in acting or as a deputy,
right,
lawfully, is entitled to, you know, carry out his duties the same way that the person who originally was in that position was supposed to carry out. In this standing orders again, we are told clearly that the person presiding shall be Mr. Speaker. In our standing orders, at the interpretation column, it says the person presiding shall be Mr. Speaker. Shall be called Mr. Speaker. That is why when you are presiding, we don't call you Mr. Deputy Speaker. We don't call you Honorable Fomina or Bekwai. We call you Mr. Speaker. So when you look at our standing orders, that says the person presiding shall be Mr. Speaker. Then you look at, you know, Article 2952. That says that when you are in an, when you are occupying a position lawfully, at a time given, whether in acting position or as deputy, you carry out all the rules or you assume all the powers of that position. And you add that also to 101 and 102, where the person presiding, the deputy speaker and the speaker are used interchangeably and given exemptions. Clearly, it tells you that when you are presiding, you are more than just a member representing a constituency. When you are not presiding and you are holding that title, you are representing a constitution and nobody, a constituency, and nobody can prevent you from voting and debating. They debate all the time when they are not presiding. But when they are presiding, they do not debate. And let me tell you, I mean, apart from even first deputy speaker's own words, or admission that goes against this ruling. I'm sure you have seen that video.
Very well.
Where he himself says that he's not voting.
Yeah.
That it is not in doubt that when you are presiding, you don't vote. He said it categorically in the chair. Apart from that, the illogic in the argument that the person presiding can vote, especially during division, is expressed in the procedure to determine a count when you call for a division. If you look at our standing orders again, how do we get to a point where you call for division? So the speaker puts a question. Those in favor will say, yeah. Ayes. Then those against will say, no. The speaker will use his ears and decide to call the vote for the side he thinks was loudest. So he can say, the nays have it. At that point, as a member, if you feel aggrieved or if you think the speaker's ears failed him, you can rise to demand that a division be taken. Now, when you are calling for a division, you are calling for the voices to be counted. The voices that took part in the vote to be counted. Not the voices that didn't take part in the vote. Because the vote is already done. Mm. But you now want to distill it to the voices that took part in the vote.
Right.
Are you getting the difference?
Mm.
So, the deputy first deputy speaker admits to us that it is not in doubt that when you are in the chair and you call for a vote, you don't take part. So when you call for a voice vote, you don't take part in that voice vote. When they are counting the voices to determine which voice is louder, your voice cannot be part of it. I don't know if you get the simple logic.
I get it.
In the argument that the person presiding, when he was not part of the voice vote, can now step down so that they will count him. I mean, you are here. Then I say, I'm calling a voice vote between the two of you. Or let's say, those the producers here.
Right.
I say, I'm calling a vote, including the producers. Then you say, I. The I's will say, I. Then you say, no. Then I say, okay, the I's have it. And you just say, you say that, no, the I's don't have it. So let's count the people who voted. And we have already determined that me, I don't take part in the shouting.
Yeah.
I won't take part. Then we are counting the voices, and I now come and say, I was part of the I. I mean, logically, it is simply irrational for anybody to think that that is what the framers of the Constitution intended when they prescribed that the speaker, the deputy speaker, the person presiding, cannot be counted to form quorum. But when it comes to the serious business of taking a decision, the person presiding, if it is not a speaker, can, you know, take part. I think it is simply unacceptable, and we agree with all those who are calling on the plaintiff to, you know, seek a review of the Supreme Court's decision. We think it's a travesty of justice, and it must not be allowed to stand. It is not a ruling that must be allowed to stand. It is dangerous for our democracy.
Right, I'll come back to you. VSC, you're still watching, hopefully this idea on
conversation with me, Justice Appiah. Those of you watching us on Facebook can share the Facebook Live for other people to also watch tonight's edition of the program. Now, let me come to you, lawyer, on the arguments. I've listened to the majority side on the matter. I've listened to the minority. You've listened to Honorable. He has espoused succinctly the minority's views on the matter. As a lawyer, has the Supreme Court erred in their decision? I'm sure you've read the judgment.
Yes, thanks, Justice. I have read the judgment. I think it's a 29-page judgment. And I have actually seen the difficulties the seven justices of the Supreme Court went through in arriving at this decision.
Right.
When you look at it, the arguments they are putting forward, if you are going to logically follow their own arguments, you won't arrive at the conclusion they arrived at.
Why so?
For instance, if you say a deputy speaker by the provisions of our own constitution, before assuming that position as a deputy speaker, was a member of parliament. You understand? And so, even as a deputy speaker, he's still a member of parliament. And so he represents his people. And so he should not be denied that
his
voting right
to vote. Yeah.
The question is, do the electorate in the constituency, the voters, do they vote the MPs only to come and vote? Don't they also elect them to come and deliberate?
Okay.
Because before you arrive at voting, you should have gone through deliberation. So, what does the Supreme Court say about the right of the deputy speaker to take part in the deliberations? Can he, at the time he's presiding, also choose to raise his hand and who will call him? To catch whose eye? And make what kind of input, and to whom, And who will he be addressing? Myself or? Because when you are talking to you people, you address Mr. Speaker. So who is he going to be addressed? And so they have kind of belittled the power given by the voters in our constituencies to their MPs. To just, they have reduced it to just voting. And so that deputy speaker has no clue. He has no useful purpose to serve our nation except to vote.
No, but that was the review. That was, the interpretation the person went to court to, of course.
Well, that was the decision. The court came to the voting.
But the person went to court, mm-hmm. To seek an interpretation on Article 102 and 104.
Mm-hmm.
And precisely it was on that.
So
and
what
they didn't want to, of course, you can also
no.
imply
when you look
that
at, when you
don't
look
want
at,
to
go
into other areas.
When you look at the provision Honorable mentioned, 110, in fact, if the Supreme Court had considered 110 appropriate, there would have been no need for any form of interpretation.
110?
Yes.
Okay.
Because it's clear. It says, subject, that is 1101, subject to the provisions of this constitution,
okay.
Parliament may, by what? Standing orders, regulate its own procedure. So it means that Parliament has the right
so
to
So the
make
constitution
orders,
has given them that mandate.
And they are only subjecting it to one condition.
Okay.
They say that the only time they cannot make orders to regulate their own procedure is when there's a constitutional provision. Now,
but what if they have a provision in the standing orders that is, inconsistent with the provision in the constitution?
So, if I ask you, what provision in the constitution is the standing order 109 rule 3 violating? In fact, when they started this whole interpretation thing, the Supreme Court itself came to the conclusion, the plaintiffs, the respondent, the state, and every party in the action came to the same conclusion that there is no clear provision in the constitution saying that a deputy speaker should vote. That is not in doubt. Just as they are saying there is no clear provision that says he shouldn't vote, there is also no clear provision in the constitution that says what? A deputy speaker should vote. There is no clear provision in the constitution. Now, the question is, subject to the provision of this constitution, Parliament may by standing order regulate this constitution. So, when there is no provision in the constitution, you can't take away the power of Parliament to make its own orders. That is what it means.
But there's a provision under Article 104 on the voting rights of the speaker. It talks about the Speaker of Parliament. It never talked about Deputy Speakers of Parliament.
So, and there's the conclusion that there's no explicit provision that gives the Deputy Speaker the right to vote.
Yes.
So if there's no provision, allow Parliament, if there's no such provision, allow Parliament to make orders. What was why Parliament made the order that today, 1093 stands for expunged. So the Parliament was perceptively in order. Now, if you read the judgment, one surprising thing that came out was how the Supreme Court took the time to extol the long-standing principles and conventions in other parliaments. You look at the UK, you look at the US, in fact, Botswana, Kenya, Supreme Court took pains to look at, apart from the position in their laws, their convention, parliamentary practices, long-standing practices. The question is, what prevented Supreme Court from going into our own properties?
Right, viewers, you're still watching Hot News Radio on Pan-African Television with me, Justice Appiah. Keep your messages coming in. We'll make a time and read all those up for you. You can as well join us on Facebook, share the Facebook Live. We'll make a time and read all those up for you. Now, let me come to lawyer once again. You can go ahead.
So, there's a paragraph, a subheading in their ruling called comparative analysis.
Yes.
Where they went to town, they went to the U.S. Congress, they went to House of Commons in the U.K., and they are respecting and extolling their...
Right, good evening, and
to Hot News. We are live on Pan-African Television. We're also live on Facebook at Pan-African Television, on YouTube at Pan-African Television, as well as 48 active channels. Join in the conversation by sending in your views, comments, or contributions on our WhatsApp to text line. We'll make a time and read all those out for you. You can as well leave your suggestions. Questions, and whatnot on our social media pages on Facebook, Instagram, and on Twitter at Pan African Television. I also read all those out for you. Those of you watching us on Facebook can share the Facebook Live for other people to also watch tonight's edition of the program. All you need to do is to like our page, you know, subscribe to our page on Facebook, on YouTube, and you get the notification of all our programs and all of that. Tonight on Hot News, we are looking at the Supreme Court's decision on the matter of a deputy speaker voting on the floor of parliament. You know that a private legal practitioner went to the Supreme Court for interpretation of Article 102 and 104 of the 1992 Constitution. We are talking about forming a quorum in parliament, which was dealt with under Article 102.
Black power, brothers and sisters, black power. It seems that we are continuing to have some slight audio with the transcribing of the audio from the Hot News broadcast from Pan-African TV, as well as Good Morning Africa. So with that being said, what I'm going to do is we're going to go and hear from one of our great archive audios here. I believe it is due time that we heard last week from the sister, what is her name, Ambassador Alakana, and I believe it is time, it has been a minute since we heard from any of our great elders. So with that being said, I believe at this time it would be valuable for us to hear from the great elder, John Henry Clark. There's a lot that is taking place as it relates to what's going on the continent. There are various wars that are taking place that have been instigated by the West. We now also have an issue in which Africans who are caught up in the war that's taking place in Ukraine are being denied the right to seek refuge out of a war-torn condition. And, of course, those of us here as Africans in the diaspora are going through hell on a daily basis. And so I want to keep things in perspective historically and just make sure that not only that we look at this in the total context of a historical perspective as well as a political perspective, because if we don't make sure that we connect as African people with what is taking place in Africa, then we're like a child wandering around as an orphan, not knowing or having a connection to their parents or to their roots. And the politics that is taking place in Africa, if you listen to tonight's broadcast, you see that they reference a few times America and the political structure of America. And we know for a fact that living here in America, the politics of this nation is not only wicked and corrupt, it does not work for us as a people. Now, I wonder, you know, which brings to mind why the brothers and sisters on the continent who have their own governance, their own economy, continue to reference what's taking place in the West. And knowing from all the information that we've gathered, all of the information of how to govern and governance and systems of government actually came out of Africa. So that shows us that colonialism and neocolonialism have done a job on our brothers and sisters even in the motherland as we speak today, who unfortunately keep referring to the system of the West, and particularly here in the U.S., as if it's some standard to be weighed against, when this system is indeed not only racist, wicked, but it's unjust. And I would suggest it would be imperative that they call unto their own intelligence and not reference those of the West. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play, it's interesting. I'm looking at a clip right now from John Henry Clark entitled Law and Order. I want to play that clip, and then I'm going to backdoor it. I'm going to play this clip. Now, I can't determine if it's a short or if it's an extended program, but if it says here 8:46, but sometimes it could be 1 hour and 8:46 because the switchboard is giving a bit of an issue. But I want to talk about Law and Order, and then there's another clip entitled African Wisdom, because it is quite frustrating, to be quite honest, that I'm listening to this program and hearing these brothers argue over policies and of what's going on in the African court, in the independent sovereign nation of Ghana, and yet they reference the U.S. Now, they did reference a couple of other countries in Africa, which they should have just stood right there. But no way, in no shape, form, or fashion, should anyone look to the U.S. system of governance as any type of a standard when this racist system here is just that. It's racist and it's unjust. Just to be clear, it's racist and it's unjust. So no, by no means is it a standard. Let's hear from the great head of John Henry Clark.
And we want to go directly to the work. I have often said history is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. The role of history is to tell a people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. But most important, the role of history, properly learned, tells the people where they still must go and what they still must be. Something has happened to us that we pay little attention to, and we are forever knocking at the door of other people, barring cultures, barring ways of life inferior to the ones we lost. When you see the strongest thing about a people, look on the flip side and you'll see the weakest. The strongest thing about African people in relationship to other people was their ability to be hospitable to strangers. The weakest thing about African people is that they did not understand the intention of those strangers. And those strangers disrupted our society from Western Asia for 3,000 years before the Europeans. We are always adopting people and following after people who don't know where they are going. And we are always equating ourselves with other people, not knowing that it is not a matter of being better or worse, it is a matter of being different. Now, I have searched for the definition of African people in the history of the world most of my life, starting with my search in the Bible and with my great-grandmother, who I love as a deity, even to the point, if faith was kind enough ever to show me the true face of God, and it turned out to be Grandmother Mary, all I'm going to do is to shrug my shoulders and say, Grandma, of all the tricks you played on me, this is the greatest. I suspected that you was God all along. What we fail to do is to see greatness and godliness in ourselves, because we have been programmed into someone else's incubator. When you are born into one cultural incubator with a special kind of cultural chemistry that goes with your makeup, your personality, and your surroundings, and when you are taking out of that and placed into another culture incubator, alien to your culture, you take on traits you never had before. Some time ago, some meat-clad women, all perfumed down and jewelry down, middle class and up, whatever that is, asked me to speak on the historical origins of black teenage pregnancy. They expected me to come and hang the black man out to dry, condemn him down through the ages, and I didn't even mention him because there was no black teenage pregnancy in Africa. There was no wife beaters in Africa. There was no men referring to women by the B word in Africa. Then where then did we pick up these traits if it didn't come out of our original incubator? We picked it up in the second incubator because the condition in the second incubator influenced our makeup. We became things most unlike ourselves. Now, my mental notes for this lecture is called Law and Order in African Societies Before and After Invasion and Slavery. And I'm pulling on the fact that I have traveled in nearly every country in Africa except South Africa. And I have lived among people, so-called primitives, who were the most civilized people I have ever met, because at first they recognized my humanity. When you live among people you've never seen before, when they make you welcome, fix special foods for you because they think you came from an alien land, they have to fix something American for you. And when they fix oatmeal for you, the one of the few foods I didn't eat growing up, and I grew up poor, and you eat every bit of it out of courtesy, you know that here is a people of warmth and kindness. And the interesting thing about this encounter is that I was in the hinterlands between Ghana and Togo, and I was with a man of the Ewe culture group. I don't use the word tribe because everybody in the world came out of a tribe. French is a tribe, English is a tribe. But when you use the word tribe toward us, you use it derogatory. So I just don't use it at all. When you use it for everybody, I use it for us. Now, the interesting thing is that they had put me up in their home, and the wife was kidding the husband because he was a clerk in one of the local Barclay banks. And she said that every time when you married me, you promised to teach me to read. She spoke better English than he, and she did not know how to read. And she said, every time you promise me you're going to teach me how to read, you get me pregnant again. No more babies until you keep your promise. She wrote me back a year later and said that she had given birth to a child. She had learned how to read, and she had actually written the letter she had sent to me. And I remember the humanity of that meeting showed me how Africans behaved among Africans before Europeans came. And this is what we have lost. How then did we behave among each other before this interference, and we began to imitate other people's manners, other people's clothes, other people's food, and sometimes, tragically, other people's women? At what point did we become dissatisfied with the people at home? Because in that second incubator, you lost the original values of the first incubator. I wondered a lot about this change. And one day in Ghana, I was visiting the superintendent of prisons in Kumasi, the capital, the cultural capital of Ghana. And I heard of what I would consider a minor crime, barely worth a long conversation. Three men were working on a job. One man faked an illness, and the other man finished his work and gave him his share of the money. On the way home, they saw him in a bar drinking it up with the ladies. That was not only a violation of law, it was a violation of something in Africa that is stronger than law, custom. You want to know how then did we control each other before the Europeans came, before the Arabs came, before those other Middle Eastern thieves came to take over our country? We controlled each other through custom that was larger and stronger than law. The family itself was a small, contained nation. The uncle was equal to the father in dispensing discipline. Everybody belonged to something. And there was no idleness because everybody had an assignment. And all girls after a certain age had a husband. And if she didn't get one automatically on her own wits and charms, the old ladies and the uncles chose one for her. This might seem unromantic to you, but at least she got one. Do you have one? The society furnished everything that you needed. The society was a mini state in itself. And then some foreign fool and faker had to come along and create the I love you marriage. And love sometimes lasts a season. But I respect you marriage kept on lasting And there was no word for divorce in their vocabulary. When you married a lady, you didn't just marry her. You married her family. And you brought together not just two people. You brought together goats and cattle and chickens and all those things came together by virtue of the marriage. And the uncles related. And you did not tell a lady the things we tell ladies now because we did not understand that in African society, the matrilineal was created. The concept that the lineage comes down through the female side. And the king's son cannot be king, but the king's sister's son could be king. Therefore, eliminating any fight between family or within the family. Now, back to this case in Kumasi of the three men. Because I was living in the home of the superintendent of prison, he attended the trial when they took this man to his head chief. The trial lasted 3 nights. And I wondered how. The man had apologized. That wasn't enough. He said he'd give the money back. That wasn't enough. And the trial kept going on. And he kept bringing in witnesses and witnesses. Then finally, near the end of the trial, in an African court, in the customary court, the accused can examine everybody in the court, including the judge. And the case is not over until the accused has called his last witness. The accused called his last witness his wife. And remember now, if she don't vindicate you, you are guilty as hell. She appealed to the court. She said that he's a generous man. He liked to think of himself as being rich, so he's always setting up the ladies. But he always brings enough food and clothes, money home for the family. He don't forget that, you know. He knows he can spend only so much, then he's got to bring the rest home. So he is, his eyes are weak now. He has been reduced to a child. His mouth is bitter. He has not spoken the truth. He would like forgiveness. But the men said that they would forgive him. But the wife said, that is not enough. You must not only forgive him, but you have to agree to work with him again. Because if those two men fail to work with him, he is dishonored. And other men will not work with him. And when they agree to work with him, he shook their hand and hugged them both and thanked them. Then the wife thanked the court for restoring his honor. What was at stake? I went back to Accra, to the home of Ghana's great lawyer, J.P. Donkwa, who had trained Nkrumah. He was then in the opposition. And I asked him, what was the trial about? And Donkwa, a typical school teacher, says, John, you're acting like a Western fool. Don't talk to me like a white man. You should know what the trial was about. So he sent me down into his library, said, read this, read that. Maybe you'll find out. Finally, I read a little pamphlet he wrote called Honor and Obligation in a Cairn Society. When I came up, his wife was fixing dinner. He was holding up the dinner for me to find the answer. I said, Dr. Donkwa, before the coming of the Europeans, African society was held together by honor and obligation. He said, you got it right now. At last you got the answer. We'll have our dinner now. why I've emphasized this is that we do not look for enough at ourselves. We do not look back far enough. We created societies that had no word for jail because no one had ever gone to one. We created these societies that were so competent, crime and punishment such as existed was taken care of within the structure of the family. And the family was not only a miniature industry, but a miniature nation. And nobody had to go on welfare because no one ever heard of welfare. The family took care of those in need. Each family took care of its own. We had created these kind of societies that had every element that went into the making of socialism and communism, every element that went into the making of Christianity, before the first European wore a shoe or lived in a house that had a window. I am emphasizing this because you have been so brainwashed in years away from home and lacking knowledge in your own culture, you think you simply cannot make it unless you depend on Europeans or follow after them when they don't know where they are going. Every society, every great idea, every humane idea that they ever touch is corrupted. They have proven that they are totally incapable of understanding or practicing democracy, Christianity, or looking humanely at other people as equal to themselves, because they are so insecure they have to pretend that they are better than other people. When we look back into our historical memory far enough, we will understand that over half of human history was over before anyone knew that a European was in the world. But how then did you control yourself? Honor and obligation. If I belong to group Y, I said that I will dishonor myself if I do something that reflects bad on group Y. Honor and obligation controlled me, and custom was stronger than law. There are certain things we do not do because we are not that kind of a people. No prostitution, no word for prostitution. Now you let people where rule over you and influence you, where prostitution is a major industry in every one of their countries, unknown to us before we came in contact with them, and you act as though you cannot make it into the world unless you follow their Christianity, which is synthetic, their democracy, which is a fraud, their philosophy, which is a lie. Because you have not looked deep enough into your own history, read the in-depth books concerning your history and how you behave one to the other before this interference. This interference came first from Western Asia, now mistakenly called the Middle East. Let's look briefly at Africa before this interference. Let's look at Nile Valley civilization. Let's look at the development of that great river civilization, the first great river civilization of the world, before the development of the Indus Valley, before the development of the Tigris and the Euphrates. Now let's look at the craving to claim Egypt as belonging to someone other than African people. Egypt is a composite nation made of many nations and cultures, all coming from the south. The Nile Valley stretches 4,000 miles into Africa. Now, if you say the Europeans built the pyramids, you got to give me a timeline on the pyramids. There was no Europeans at the time. There was no place on earth called Europe at the time. He was emerging from the Ice Age. So now let's use some logic. Would he come from under the ice in Europe, come all the way to Africa, build a great civilization, go back to Europe, get under the ice, and stay 2,000 years before he build a shoe for himself or a house with a window? The Asians didn't do it because African civilization hadn't spread into Asia to awaken them. You find it difficult to look at yourself as the mother and father of what people call civilization. The first social order, the first organized religion, the first stone temple. You let your children come home and say, mathematics is hard. Look, boy, I'll spank your behind if I hear you say it again. We invented mathematics. If it's hard for you, it must have been harder for the Africans who put up the pyramids, and the pyramids are still standing. They must have done a good job. They worked it out. It's hard for you to look at yourself alone in the world, uninfluenced by foreigners, working out the first laws that would govern man, working out the philosophy and the social thought that would ultimately go into the making of an anthology called the Bible. They would take your teachings and they would call it their own. They would take African animal stories and personify it with using human beings, and you think they've got something original. These are African stories retold. The story of the Exodus was an African story 3,000 years before the Jews touched foot in Africa. Now, I've used the wrong word. There was no such thing as the Jews in that time in history. The word Jew is not a Western Asian origin. It is not an ancient word. It is a word of European origin. And the people of the Hebrew faith during that period of time were just Western Asians converted to the Hebrew faith. And there's one thing you have to consider and think about. When they came into Africa as visitors, escaping famine, they had no clear religion, they had no clear language, they had no clear culture. When they left, they had all three. So what is the origin of the people you now refer to as Jews? What is their culture origin? What is their religious origin? And do these Western Asian people relate to the Europeans who adopted the faith belatedly and was eventually called, referred to as Jews. Now, I'm dealing with the interference with Africa's golden age. I said that Africa has had three golden ages, and they could have a fourth one if we got ourselves together and believe in ourselves, because all the ingredients out of which it can be made is either in our hands or could be in our hands if we just believed in ourselves well enough to know we were the first people to build a state, the first people to build an institution, the first people to lay out laws that will not only govern us, but eventually govern all mankind. Now, let's go back to the copying that went into the making of the Bible. I know the Bible is sacred to you. It's supposed to be all true. You believe in the Adam and Eve story and all the story about the ark. These things are precious to your mind, but these are stories taken from us and retold. Now, I'll tell you just one, the origin of the Exodus story. There was a Pharaoh one day who got a little despondent, and during those days, all pharaohs had magicians. There's a two-volume work on it, The Role of Magic and the Creation of Religions. The real story of religions is beautiful. These stories are beautiful, very educational, but you ain't going to read it because you're going to debunk all the nonsense you think you know about religion. But this Pharaoh and his magician got together, and the magician said he thought he would take him for a ride down the Nile in a rowboat. And to make things more pleasant, all the rowers were good-looking girls. So the lead girl stopped the boat and started crying. And the Pharaoh asked, what is wrong? And so the magician went up to see what was wrong. She said she lost her bracelet. She leaned over too far. She dropped her bracelet. And the Pharaoh said, no, you take care of this. So the magician went and parted the water, reached out on dry land, picked up the bracelet, gave it to her, the necklace, and she now smiling, the water coming back, and they rolled down the Nile. That's the origin of the Exodus story. Somebody else tells it about 600,000 people crossing, running from a Pharaoh. Now, the fact that the Pharaoh they were running from has a mummy in Cairo Museum right now proves they did. If they drowned him, they rescued him. Another thing about the story, escaping the Pharaoh's army, you couldn't have escaped the Pharaoh's army because he controlled both sides of the river. He had armies on both sides. All right, you drain a river of water. You got a deep gorge, deep muddy gorge. 600,000 people without the loss of a chicken or a cow? You gonna believe this? Come on, give me a break. You believe other people's retelling of your story, but you won't believe the real story. And the other part of the story is that these were the first visitors to Africa. And after the visitors came, the conquerors came, the first conquerors, 1675. And these visitors joined the conquerors and became clerks and collaborators with the conquerors, forgetting the Africans who had befriended them, gave them homes, gave them food, and because the African is a perfect host, saw some of them without women, gave them women. We are so kind. Now look at our strong point and how other people took advantage of it and reduced us to servitude because we were kind enough to open the door without asking whether he was a thief and a murderer. We are still giving thieves and murderers the benefit of the doubt while we distrust each other. Now, during this period of the foreign kings, they produced the world's first wheeler, dealer, politician, Joseph, called the provider. Why could he provide? He had the ear of the foreign king. Then a king arose who knew not Joseph. Who is this king who knew not Joseph? The African king coming back to power and owed the Jewish people and Joseph no favors. Now the African would say, those who wish to obey African law can stay. The rest of you will have to go. Those in the so-called Exodus were those who decided to go. They had gained many things in Africa, including the leadership of a mythological African called Moses, who was escaping from the Pharaoh's wrath because he had murdered one of the Pharaoh's messengers. And he had to put some space between him and the Pharaoh. So he agreed to lead them out. Now, if you look at the story of Moses coming to the promised land, why did he get to the edge of the promised land and was turned back? Because he wasn't one of them. Now you see an early show of Hebrew nationalism. You don't know where to leave people out. They're human just like us. Let them in. Yeah, they'll let you in to do you in. When the sons and daughters of Ireland call a meeting, they don't want no non-Irish. When the Hebrews call a meeting, a special meeting, they don't want no non-Hebrews. And if you do it, you call a racist, a separatist. But do it anyway. You better do it. We are the only people who get condemned for loving ourselves and taking pride in ourselves. Now, after this period, this first interference, you have to look at what has happened. These foreigners had interfered with African customs. They had bastardized African women. They had begun to produce a generation of people who wasn't African and wasn't Asian, didn't know who they wanted to be loyal to. We have not dealt with bastardization as a factor in history and a dangerous factor in history because when you're in between, you don't know who to be loyal to. And in a real revolution, who kills you depends on who sees you first because neither side trusts you. That's a cold fact of history. Now, Africa's recovered from this period, the end of the first golden age, to go on to have another golden age lasting 1,000 years. Now the conquerors came back, the Assyrians, now called Syrians. The Iranians, then called Persians. They were so bad, they opened the door for a young Greek with a gender problem called Alexander the so-called Great. This was the first European occupation of any part of Africa, followed by the Romans, another bunch of well-dressed thugs. They killed people for being Christians, and Christianity got so influential, they stopped killing Christians and became Christians politically. Became Christians because it was to their convenience. And the person who proclaimed it, Constantine, was a degenerate. A bunch of religious people called the Essens propositioned him and told him, if you're going to follow this new religion, you got to give up some of your degenerate ways. Women hanging around in the palace, naked, he's fornicating all over the place. He said he'd give that up. He could do that in private, so. Then they told him that he had to give up eating red meat. Then he lost his temper. So keep your religion. Go help us. And finally they said, well, we are vegetarians. We'll let you have your meat. And so a compromise was made. He proclaimed Christianity to be the official religion of the Holy Roman Empire. By 600, the Romans had disgraced themselves in the mismanagement of the faith and had destroyed the many Africans in the faith, had declared war on the early African Christians to the point where a camel boy began to grumble and ask for reform. Failing to get reform, he asked for a new religion. Now this might hurt a whole lot of people's feelings, but Islam came into being so fast. It is the least original and the least imaginative of all of the world's religions. They stole a little bit from Zoroastrianism, a little bit from Judaism, a little bit from old Christianity. They put it together so fast, there is no truly great Islamic literature. And the Quran is a composite that a whole lot of people talk about and don't read. But the Africans, thinking that the Arabs would help to get the Romans off of their back, were right. The Arabs helped to get the Romans off their back and replaced the Romans on their back, and the Arabs are still on their back. Remember, everybody in Africa who cannot be called an African is either an invader or a descendant of an invader. When militarily Africans clean house, it's going to have to include the pseudo-whites as well as the whites. And you don't have to have the Arab in order to have Islam, because the Arab is the most corrupt element within Islam. Two Africans helped to make the faith, two Ethiopians. Zayd bin Harith, Ibn Rabit Bilal. And Ethiopia protected this faith when it was about to be driven out of Arabia. And the Prophet Muhammad told his followers, go to Ethiopia. Go to that land of righteousness where no one is wrong. And he said on his deathbed, Islam will never forsake Ethiopia when Ethiopia is in distress. No nation in Africa has suffered more then and now at the hands of Islam than Ethiopia. Only a few years ago, the Muslims coming down from the north to destroy the previous Ethiopian government, African Muslims, blacks, were capturing pretty Ethiopian women and turning them over to Arab dogs. Now, if you demean yourself in the name of a religion, then it is not a religion. All religions are good when they are used for good purposes. All of them are bad when they are used to spread hate and to enslave people. What you do not understand is nearly all organized religions are male chauvinist murder cults. They not only took the woman out of the center of religion, where religion started. The African had no problem with the female god, and had many of them. He assigned the goddess Nu the job of taking down the sun and putting it in her vagina overnight and taking it out and putting it up in the morning. Now, if you give a woman that assignment to make day and night, that means you are not afraid of her, and you must trust her, because she can fail and the whole world will be in darkness. Now, this is symbolically speaking, but even symbolically speaking, look at the beauty of the symbol. Look at the trust. And at what point did we begin to put women in the background? Who said, women, you too bossy? We grew up in a society where women had a central place, and they could go as far as their mind could take them without making any man feel insecure. The European man is insecure with women. He made us feel insecure. In every one of our churches, in every one of our lodges, in every one of our organizations, there is one woman we call Big Mama, even if she only weighs 100 pounds. Because she's the boss. She keeps things together. In the Baptist church, if the women leave, they have to close their doors. The pastor won't get his annual suit. Money for his vacation, money for his car, all this is maneuvered by women. And while the deacons vote for a new minister or not, he dare not vote without consulting his wife. So the women are ruling behind the scenes, because you've been hanging out with too many white people who are afraid of women. You think she's taking away our manhood. She is buying us the time to be better men. Look at it that way. She don't want you to be a wimp. This is why she's been taking care of so many things to free you to develop as a man. We have misinterpreted this because we listened to some other drummer of another culture. Now, I said there were three golden ages in Africa. And now let's deal briefly with that third one, then come briefly to the United States. That third golden age began to start when the Africans and the Arabs drove the Romans out of Africa. And the Europeans had to go back into Europe, where they created what they call the Dark Ages. Europe never flourishes until they have people outside of Europe that they can exploit. Free labor, free land, free resources. They're looking for it again to recover from all the stupid walls that they fastened on this world. In inner Western Africa, nations began to develop. Ghana, Mali, Sangay. Sangay was as large as the United States, ruled by Africans. Ghana was ruled by sacred kings. The last of their kings was Ten Kamene, known as the king who rode out twice a day, every day. He would ride out and administer justice to his people, hold court. No one was obliged to remove themselves from his presence until they were satisfied that justice had been done in their case. This was royal democracy at its best. Democracy did not begin to decline until someone began to use the word. Christianity did not begin to deteriorate until someone began to use the word. Someone began to formalize it and dogmatize it around a personality called Jesus Christ. But St. Augustine, looking at the Conference at Nicaea, when the Europeans made the religion European and a handmaiden for their conquest, he said, these people make me laugh. They're trying to give us a religion we had 3,000 years ago, which indeed we did. But we didn't call it by no name. We just practiced it. We didn't say, I am my brother's keeper. Because if you got to say it, I'm afraid you don't mean it. Just keep it. And don't talk about it. We produce societies so well governed by custom that we did not need civil law as you know civil law. Once the foreigners came in, they convinced us of a tragedy that we are still suffering from. They laughed at our gods and told you God can't possibly look like you. And when you bought back, you were in a trap. And you're still in that trap. It is hard for you to imagine God looking anything like Michelangelo's painting, who painted it 1,500 years after the death of Christ. Now, how can the hell did Michelangelo, who also had a problem, knew how Christ looked? One of his relatives was the model for Christ. Another relative was the model for Moses. How did he know that Moses had a beard? And yet you don't ask him a question. He painted the Last Supper. And he got one artist, one model. Then he needed 12 more models. He was a little short of money. So where did he get the models from? Some men who wasn't doing anything from the local jail. So he dressed them up and painted them. And you so dewy-eyed, well, look, that's Peter, that's Paul. That's a bunch of dressed-up jailbirds. And you buying the picture without asking any questions. Now you need to read Dr. Ben's work, The African Origins of the Three Major Western Religions. John Jackson is still alive. One of his last big books was Christianity Before Christ. He also did a book, Pagan Origins of the Christ Myth, dealing with the pictures of Christ in all kinds of societies. Now let's go with this third golden age, which began to end concurrent with the rise of the slave trade. This great nation, Songhay, existed inland. It had great universities, university city, Genie. It had a great university at Timbuktu, so well organized the Arabs did not or could not teach at Timbuktu at the University of Sankore. They wasn't brilliant enough. The great teachers had to teach 10 subjects well. The last of the great chancellors was Achmed Baba, an African who had written 47 books, each on a separate subject, and he had never gone to any place for education outside of inner West Africa. Now, people tell you that the slave trade happened, but they don't tell you what else was happening. The great independent states in West Africa was flourishing, and they would not fall until 150 years after the slave trade had started. The great city-states of East Africa were flourishing until the Arabs forced the slave trade on that part of Africa using their mulatto offsprings in relationship and cooperation with the Portuguese. The Arabs were in the slave trade before Islam, and many brothers who tried to purify the Arabs by saying Islam is the black man's true religion, inasmuch as all the elements that went into the making of all religions came out of Africa, then all religions are the black man's true religion. And any time you use one religion to put one people against another people, you're making the wrong use of religion. You're making God ungodly. Every major religion of the world have used that religion to enslave other people. What I'm saying is now, after the Crusades, another faker in history that I don't have time to explain, because if you think it has something to do with religion, then you are misguided. It was a raping party. They raided everything in sight. Not only took the farmer's plow, took the farmer's daughter. They were so-called rescuing the Holy Grail. It wasn't lost in the first place, wasn't holy in the second place. But they had drained Europe of so much energy that Europe went into a period of famine and plagues. And one of the main reasons for the famines and plagues was the lack of sanitation. The Europeans had not used a simple substance commonly known as soap. They had not then began to use washable underwear that was introduced into Spain by the Africans in a basic culture. They had lost the concept of longitude and latitude. And once they regained this maritime skill, mostly from the Chinese, the leading maritime nation of that day, who had 1,000 years relationship with Africans, they built the ships that launched the slave trade. And out of nowhere came a hustler, a liar, a murderer, who discovered absolutely nothing, known as Christopher Columbus. If you want further explanation, and if you forgive the modesty, my last book is Christopher Columbus in the African Holocaust. Any black bookstore will get it. It's small, so it's cheap. You can't get hurt. I'm always stopping in the middle of big books to do little books. I was doing 3 books dealing with the liberation movement outside of Africa. The big book, Notes for an African World Revolution, is one. The one that I'm finishing now, Condition Reflex, The Dilemma of the Africans Away from Home, is the second. And after that, I would do a book called Immigrants Against Their Will, The Africans in the Americas in the Caribbean Islands. We are the only immigrants who came with an invitation. The nature of the invitation will not be discussed here, because the invitees brought ships and guns and chains. They were so good, so anxious to keep us in the boats, they chained us down. And when we arrived, no unemployment problem, plenty jobs, no pay. But what we did made America set in motion the modern scientific and technical age. Now stop your children from crouching and looking at skyscrapers as though God put them up there, put up from wealth stolen from us. We should start claiming them. And those talking about reformation, putting a figure on it, forget about the figure. I take the whole treasury. You can keep the change.